AccessCast, an Accessibe initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibe and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibe, that's AccessibE. Visit www.accessibe.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Good morning or afternoon, wherever you happen to be, and welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. Today, our guest is Donald Skip Montragon, and I met Donald not too long ago, actually, at Podapalooza. We've talked about that before. It's an event where podcasters, would-be podcasters, and people who want to be interviewed by podcasters all get together. Sometimes one person is all three at once. But I met Skip and we talked a little bit and I said, would you be interested and willing to come on the podcast? And he said, yes. So now he's stuck with us because here we are. Skip, how are you?
I am doing great, Michael. Delighted to be here.
Now, where are you located?
I am in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, sir.
So there you go. 2 hours ahead of where we are. And any fires nearby? Hopefully not.
No, sir. Thank you, Lord.
Right now, us the same way, and we're blessed by that. But it is getting hot in both places, isn't it?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Well, tell me a little bit about you, maybe your early life and so on, and you know, we'll kind of go from there.
Yes, sir. I'm the third of eight children born of Hispanic parents, of meager means, but born in Denver, Colorado. My father went to the Korean War and came back a broken man. The man that went to war was not the man that came home. He suffered, I'm convinced, with bipolar disorder, PTSD, and he was an alcoholic. And when my dad drank, he was violent. My sister, my elder sister Roma, tells us that when my dad would come home, we would run and hide because we didn't know which dad was coming home, the kind, gentle, fun-loving dad, or the angry, mean, violent dad. So this was my early childhood. I actually don't have memories before the age of 7, other than a couple little fleeting memories. So I don't remember a lot of that. I get history really from my sister, my older sister, my elder sister.
Is that because you just blocked it out or something worse?
Yes, sir. Yes. Uh-huh. It's gone. I just don't have those memories. Yeah. They're not accessible. But that was my early childhood. It was chaotic. It was chaotic. It was traumatic. But I came from a very loving family. Seven siblings. We're all close in age. 10 years separate us. We're still close to this day. Enjoy being together with one another. Loud, boisterous.
Are they in Texas?
Very affectionate. No, none of my siblings are in Texas. I have a brother in the Baltimore area, Baltimore, Maryland, one in Raleigh, North Carolina. I'm here in Texas. The others are all in Colorado.
So I guess with a number in Colorado, that's the meeting place, huh?
Yes, sir. Between my wife and I, my mother is the only living parent. And so we go back home, as we call it, to visit in Colorado. Yes, sir.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that.
Indeed.
So you grew up. Did you go to college?
Yes, sir. Intended to start my college career at the University of Notre Dame, ROTC scholarship. Left there my fifth semester, confused, not quite sure what I was going to do. There's this tug. Am I going to go into ministry versus medicine? I was pre-med at the time, left school, was out of school for almost three and a half years, trying to decide what I was going to do. And then I transferred into Oral Roberts University, where I finished my undergraduate work, Oral Roberts University in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Mm-hmm. And there I went to medical school, and it's there at ORU that I met my sweetheart, Sherry. And this year we celebrated our 41st wedding anniversary.
You're just ahead of us by a year and a half, I guess, because our 40th will be in November.
Oh, congratulations.
Which is great. Now, we knew the marriage was going to last. I'm going to get shot for this, I'm sure. But we knew our marriage was going to last because the wedding was supposed to start at 4 p.m. on a Saturday, the 27th of November of 1982.
Yes, yes.
And the church was not filled up like it was supposed to be at 4 o'clock. And it got to be, and I remember it well, 4:12, suddenly the doors opened and this whole crowd of people came in. And So we started, although it was 4 or 12 minutes late, or 15 by the time they got in.
Sure.
And it wasn't until later that we learned that everyone was out in their cars until the end of the USC Notre Dame game. Being here in California, my wife getting her master's from USC.
Oh my gosh.
We knew the marriage was going to last when we learned that USC whomped the snot out of Notre Dame that day.
Oh, so. Yes. We took some whippings from USC, albeit.
You've given back.
I was at Notre Dame that year that we beat them and went on to win the national championship in 73. Yep. So that was a turn of events, if you will, after taking some real whippings the years preceding that from USC.
I gained an appreciation for football in all seriousness when it was a couple of years later. I was in Los Angeles and at a meeting, and somebody was listening on the radio and keeping us apprised of the fact that at the end of the first half, Notre Dame was leading USC 24-0. And then I got in the car and we started going home, and USC started scoring and scoring. It was with Anthony Davis and that whole crowd.
Oh, man.
You know about that game. And by the time it was over, it was 55-24 USC. But it's a great rivalry, and I'm glad it exists.
Right. I think the next year is when they came to South Bend and they hung him in effigy. So I remember they had this thing there, and it's like, oh, beat USC. Don't let him run against just like that again.
Oh, it makes it fun. And as long as it's a game like that and people view it that way, it's great.
There you go. It's a game. That's all. It's a game.
It needs to be. Don't take it too seriously by any means.
No, sir.
But it's a lot of fun. So after Oral Roberts and so on, you went off and had some adventures.
Yes, sir.
What happened next?
Well, I went to do further training, internship and residency in Canton, Ohio. And there it was a turn of events. I had expected I was going to do a military internship and go on and complete my residency with the military. But I received this Dear John letter approximately 6 weeks before the interview season was going to close, the Army telling me I did not receive an Army internship and I had to pursue a civilian internship. And I'm thinking, are you kidding me? I was supposed to be in the Army next year. I hadn't even looked at civilian internships. And so I was scrambled. This was a days before the internet. You had to go to the library, look up programs, phone numbers, call them, find out what they needed so you could apply to that program, what documents they needed, send to each program individually, the documents, the letters, arrange a flight. Now they have a centralized application system. So you complete one application, your letters of reference are all uploaded there. Then you decide which programs you want these sent to.
What year was this?
So I'm doing this you know, post haste, thinking this application season is ending. Christmas is going to be approaching and then there's nothing going to get done. And so I got to get this done. And it was hectic. Ended up in Canton, Ohio. And it was fabulous. I had the best of both worlds, great academics, fabulous clinical teaching. And it just so happened, the new program director was retired Brigadier General Andre J. Ognaby. And he scared the snot out of us.
What year was this? What year did this take place?
I arrived there in 1985.
Got it. So he scared the snot out of you. Huh?
Oh, my gosh. We called him Dr. O, the big O, or the O. And when he was coming, we were like, oh, no, the O's coming. Oh. We'd be at morning report. We'd be talking about new cases that were admitted the night before. And he'd ask me to present the case or ask questions. And I would feel like I feel like the voices on Charlie Brown. I go home and I tell my wife, oh, I can't seem to answer one question intelligently when he is around. He must think I'm the stupidest intern he has ever seen. I just get so flustered when he was around. I went then in a few months to him because I was planning on doing physical medicine rehabilitation, but I had really fallen in love with internal medicine because my first few months were on the general internal medicine wards and then a month in the the intensive care unit. And I really fell in love with internal medicine. I went to him and talked and said, Dr. O, I'd like to talk to you. I'm interested in internal medicine, but I don't know that I could be a good internist. And I remember him looking at me and saying, Skip, you could be a good internist. In fact, you could be a very good internist, and we'd love to keep you in the program. I could write letters of deferment so you can stay in the program and train here. And that was the turning point for me.
Blew you away.
He actually became very good friends. My last year, he asked me to be the chief resident. I didn't accept because we were expecting our third child at that time, preparing to move to join the Army. And I just couldn't put that pressure on my wife at that time. But we're still good friends to this day.
Yeah, that's
he
great.
And his wife. So it went from being that bumbling intern to a competent senior resident to friendship as the years went on.
So he figured you out and obviously saw something in you, and you kind of figured him out a little bit, it sounds like.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Where is he today?
He is here in Texas. He's outside of San Antonio, he and his wife, Margaret.
That's a little bit closer than Canton, Ohio.
Oh, yes, sir.
Well, that's great that you guys are still friends and you can see each other. That is the way it ought to be.
Indeed.
It's always great when you can establish a relationship with a teacher. You know, I wrote Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust at Ground Zero. When I talk in there about Dick Herbolsheimer, my geometry teacher, and to this day, we are still friends and chat on the phone on a regular basis.
That reminds me of my junior high wrestling coach, John Gregerson. We are great friends to this day. And we hadn't seen one another for almost been 15 plus years. I had seen him at the 1994 NCAA Wrestling Championships, Division I in North Carolina, and hadn't seen him till 2000. Approximately 2015, something like that. We hadn't seen one another, but got in touch with him because he had moved back when he retired from teaching there in Colorado. He moved to Wyoming, then moved back to Colorado. We got in touch with him, said, to get in touch with you, John. We met one another, talked. It was like we hadn't been apart. And I remember upon leaving, looking at him, saying, John, I love you. And he looked at me and said, Skip, I love you too. And a great man, a great relationship. And there's so much affection in my heart and appreciation for that man, the things he taught me.
So wrestling is a part of your life, I guess.
Oh, my goodness. It's in my blood.
Well, tell me about that a little bit, if you would, please.
Oh, yes. I was miserable at sports. Any sport growing up, I didn't know how to throw. I didn't know how to catch. I didn't know how to kick. I didn't know how to run. I failed at tetherball.
Okay.
I didn't know the skills. I wasn't taught the skills. So wrestling was the first sport that I went out for in eighth grade that I thought, after a few practices, I think I can be good at this. And I began to think, I think I could be really good at this. Now, it was the first time that I wasn't having to compete against boys that were a lot bigger than I was, because I was typically the smallest kid in my class. And so I was wrestling in the 85-pound weight class in eighth grade, the lowest weight class. I was having good success. I was the only eighth grader on the varsity team. I didn't win a match that year, but I learned lots, gained a lot of confidence. The next year I come into the wrestling room, I'm the best wrestler in that wrestling room. But I get so worked up before a match, I couldn't sleep a wink all night long. So I'd go into that match utterly exhausted mentally and physically and underperform. However, the summer afterwards, I won the first tournament I entered was a state freestyle wrestling tournament, one of the Olympic styles. Win my first match, win my second, win my third match, win my fourth match. Now I'm wrestling for the championship and I win. After that, my coach asked me, "Do you know who this guy was you're wrestling?" "I have no idea, coach." And he said, "That guy won this tournament last year." And that further cemented my love for this sport. Went on, he was a two-time district champion in high school, state runner-up, and honorable mention All-American. So I had a lot of success, more so in freestyle wrestling. A lot of state tournaments. I won many state tournaments, placed in two national wrestling tournaments as a high schooler. And then after that, I wrestled some in college and some in freestyle also. But the last time I competed was in 2012 and 2013 in the Veterans Nationals.
How did that go?
Oh, how did that go? Well, it went great. I had been wanting to compete again. That bug, I still had that bug. I thought, I'd like to do this. The dates and the training, I couldn't work that in. But I'm sitting up in the stands watching the state finals of the Georgia state finals with my youngest son, Joey. He had completed his wrestling career. Had he not been ill and injured, he would have been wrestling on that stage that night. He was one of the best 112 pounders in the state of Georgia, but being ill and injured, he wasn't there wrestling that night. So we're watching this. I had this wrestling magazine. I think it was USA Wrestling. And I'm looking at these dates. Veterans Nationals was going to be held in conjunction with the Senior Nationals. And I'm looking at this. Tucson, Arizona, May 5th and 6th. I say, "Joey, you'll train with me. I'd like to compete." Well, my 18-year-old son looks and he goes, "Okay, Dad, but you're going to have to do everything I tell you." So Joey became my training partner, my trainer, and my manager. We trained hard, very hard. So this was mid-February. And at first week in May, we're going out to Tucson. Those first 6 weeks, and I was in great shape. I mean, I trained, worked out like a fanatic. But those first few weeks, you know, oh, my gosh, you know, I'd come home from practice. Oh, my wife would go, "Have you had enough, old man? Have you had enough?" "I think I'm going to go soak in the tub, honey." And I'd sit on the couch with ice on a shoulder or a knee or an elbow or sometimes all of those. But week by week, my body toughened. There was the day I got up because I added an early morning workout in addition to my afternoon workouts, bring my weight down, help a little bit with the conditioning. And my feet hit the floor. I got out to do my workout. And I thought, am I feeling good? I thought, "Joey, you better bring your A game today because the old man is feeling good. So we went out to Tucson, won a national championship. And we're sitting there taking this picture with this stop sign of a trophy that I got here. It's big. That Joey asked me, Dad, was it worth it? All those hot baths, all those ice packs. And I look at him and grin. I say, yes, son, it was worth it. I had a blast. The next year was a national runner-up. So those were the last times I competed. But I've coached. I've been around the sport. My sons all wrestled. My four sons, my four brothers, they're all younger. They all wrestled. My brother-in-law wrestled. My father-in-law was a college wrestler. Wrestling's in my blood. In fact, my kids call me a wrestling groupie because I collect wrestling cards. I get wrestling card signed. I get poster signed. I mug with all these wrestling greats. I'm friends with world champions and Olympic champions. It's in my blood.
What's the difference between Olympic style wrestling and I guess other forms like freestyle wrestling and so on?
Okay, so freestyle and Greco-Roman are the two Olympic styles. Primary difference in those two styles is in Greco-Roman, you can't attack the legs. That's the difference in those two. Now, the difference in our style, what we call schoolboy or sometimes called catch-as-catch-can, is you also have what we call a down and up position that are done differently the way that is in the scoring. To score, for instance, a takedown, when you take them to the mat, you have to have more control. In freestyle, it's much faster, or in Greco, you don't have to show the control. You just have to show the exposure of the back. Plus, you can get a five-point move with a high-flying exposure of the back, or if you take a patient an opponent from feet to back in freestyle or Greco, you can get 4 points. Or like I said, if it's high-flying, five-point move potentially, whereas in our style, American style, it's 2 points for a takedown. Doesn't matter, take them straight to the back. You could get additional points by exposing the back if you hold them there long enough for what we call a near fall. And then there's riding time. So if you're on the top position and you control that man for a minute or longer, you're getting riding time. So there's those factors that you have. So it's and the rules are somewhat different. So those are the basic differences in our style and the Olympic styles.
But wrestling scoring is pretty much then absolutely objective. It's not subjective. It's not an opinion sort of thing. Well, there are specifics,
but then you get into those subjective things.
Yeah.
It's a caution. It's a stall. It's this. And you're saying, are you kidding me? Or they say, that's not a takedown. You're going, what? What do you mean that's not a takedown? You got to be blind not to call that a takedown. So there's still some subjectivity to it. Sure, there is. You know, or they miss something. The ref misses something and you're thinking, you got to be blind, dude. You know, that was a takedown.
Hey, that's an insult. No. Now, here's my question. Has there ever been a time that both wrestlers go after the ref? You know, just checking.
I have never seen that. I have seen some come off there and give a scathing something to the ref. Yeah, you cheated me, you gypped me. And we have this saying, though, never leave it in the hands of the ref. Never leave it in the hands of the ref.
Yeah.
You don't want to leave a match in the hands of the ref. Don't let it come down to that. Wrestle your match, so there's no question.
Well, so you have wrestled a lot. You went from Canton, then I guess you joined the Army?
Correct. Join the Army.
Uh-huh. Well, if you would tell me a little bit about that and what you did and so on.
1989, our first duty station, Lawton, Oklahoma, Fort Sill. Got there on this dreary day. It was January 3rd, I believe. Oh, it was gray, dark, you know, overcast, cold. Only knew two people. My sponsor and his wife, they were the only people we knew when we arrived. I had gone earlier to rent a home for us. And then we were waiting. Our household goods were arriving. we got there. We had three young children. Adam was 4, Chris was 2, and Angelie was 4 months old. And we get there, we're moving in, getting settled. I'm in processing to the Army. So everything's new to us. And then I start practicing as a doctor, had 2 colleagues in internal medicine. But within 6 months of me joining the Army, or if you will, coming on active duty, I shouldn't say joining, I had already been on inactive status in the Army, going through school and training. But getting there at Fort Sill, they turn around and say, well, your one colleague, Keith Conkle was his name, he's going to do a fellowship in infectious disease. And then my other colleague, Lee Southmead, our senior colleague in internal medicine, was chief of the clinic, chief of the ICU. He decided very abruptly to get out and do a nephrology fellowship, civilian fellowship. So he was getting out of the Army. Now they say, well, Skip, you're now the chief of the internal medicine clinic. You're the medical officer, the chief of the intensive care unit. And guess what? You're the only internal medicine physician we're going to have for the summer. Have a good summer. Oh, it was the worst summer I've ever had in my life. It was utterly miserable. Oh, it was horrible.
How so?
I was so busy there with patients and care and responsibilities there, and having to tell some patients, I'm sorry, we don't have capacity for you. You're going to have to be seen in the civilian sector. Now, mind you, when my 2 new colleagues came, we had all these patients streaming back saying, please, 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 may I come back? Because they knew the care we rendered was superior to what they were getting, the care they were receiving in the civilian sector. But it was such a demanding, physically and emotionally and time-wise, I was spending inordinate amounts of time at the clinic and hospital.
So what does internal medicine take in?
Internal medicine, we are specialists for adults. You think of the gamut of non-surgical diseases. We take care of adults 18 to end of life. And so our training entails taking care of the common cold, a community-acquired pneumonia that you can treat as an outpatient, to taking care of the patient that's in the ICU hooked up to life support. That's the scope of what we're trained in. So if you think of the common diseases of adults, high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, lung disease, arthritis, gastrointestinal problems, this is the bailiwick of an internal medicine physician.
Our biggest exposure to that, first of all, my sister-in-law was a critical care unit and ICU nurse for a lot of her life, and then retired. But anyway, in 2014, my wife contracted double pneumonia and ARDS, A-R-D-S.
Oh my gosh.
And she ended up in the hospital on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And what they were trying to constantly do was to force air into her lungs to try to push out some of the pneumonia. They actually had to use, and you'll appreciate this, a PEEPS level of 39 just to get air into her lungs.
Sure. They were so stiff. Yeah.
They were so stiff. And no one at the hospital had ever seen any situation where they had to use so much air pressure to get air into her lungs to start to move things around and get rid of the pneumonia. Everyone came from around the hospital just to see the gauges.
Yeah. Yeah. And they probably told you, you know, this risks injuring her lungs because the pressures are so high. But we're not going to be able to oxygenate her.
Right. And what they said basically was that if she didn't have pneumonia, her lungs would have exploded with that kind
exactly.
of pressure.
Exactly.
Because what the average individual, when you're inhaling, is a PEEPS level of like between 2 and 5. So 39 was incredibly high.
Oh, yes. Absolutely.
But she survived.
I'm glad she recovered.
She did. We're glad about that. Right. But she was in the hospital for a month, and she was in an induced coma using propofol.
Right.
And when she came out of all that, I asked her if she dreamed about singing Thriller and Bad and all that. I was mean. But no, she.
What an ordeal. Wow.
Well, and that's what, and eventually caused us to move down here to Southern California to be closer to relatives. But I really appreciated what the doctors did for her. And we're very grateful and fully understand a lot of what goes on with internal medicine. And she has a good doctor now that we work with, we both work with. And so we're very pleased with that. But yes, so you were in charge of internal medicine, and how long did that last at your first station?
First duty station, we arrived in 89. We were there till 92, till summer of 92. So arrived in January 89. I graduated off cycle in Canton. Left in summer of 92, went to Walter Reed Army Medical Center. But while I was at Fort Sill, it was the first time I deployed to Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. Mm-hmm. My first deployment, and it was found out just days, like the week before, that my wife was expecting our fourth child, our son Jonathan. Got home in time for 11 days before his birth. Thank you, Lord. But that was my first deployment, and that was harrowing in that we were the first major medical group in theater, 47 Field Hospital. And we knew that Saddam had chemical weapons and that his Scud missiles could reach where we were at in Bahrain. So it was some harrowing times with that, getting our hospital set up and knowing that we were well within range of Scud missiles. The alarms would go off and we'd be throwing on our protective gear, we call them mop gear, our masks and all our other protective gear, and these outrageous high temperatures. Just, you know, within a couple minutes, you were just drenched with sweat, just pouring off of you in that heat until you'd hear the alarms go off again, all clear. Thankfully, we'd never were bombed with a Scud, but we were well within the range, and we knew we had used chemical weapons, so we knew they certainly were in this arsenal. So that was my first deployment, and then Walter Reed, where I did a fellowship 2 years there in Washington, D.C., and then we were off to Brooke Army Medical Center, and that was San Antonio, one of my favorite cities, at Fort Sam Houston. And we were there for 4 years. And on the heels of that, I was deployed to Haiti for 7 months. The last months that we lived there. So I was gone. I'm just redeploying, returning home. And we're in the process of moving. Now we're moving to Fort Hood, Texas. There we spent actually 8 years at Fort Hood. And there I was, again, chief of the Department of Medicine at Fort Hood. Had amazing staff, great people that I worked with, wonderful patients everywhere I went, just wonderful patients to take care of. And then I was deployed during that time to Operation Iraqi Freedom. It was OIF-1, Operation Iraqi Freedom 1, 2003-2004. Stationed up in Mosul, caring primarily for the 101st Airborne Division Air Assault. Major General David Petraeus was a division commander at that time. I got to work closely. My last few months, I was the officer in charge of the hospital, 21st Combat Support Hospital, and got to work closely, interact with General Petraeus and his staff. Amazing man, amazing staff, incredible experience. And then from there, after Fort Hood, we went back to Fort Sill, which is an interesting experience because then I was the deputy commander of clinical services, the chief medical officer of the hospital. So the first time I was there, I was a newly minted captain, new to the Army. You don't expect you to know much about the Army. Now I go back to Fort Sill. I'm in the command suite. I'm the chief medical officer of the hospital. Now, as a colonel, they expect you to know everything. it was interesting. Now, one of the first few days I was there, they give me a tour around to various places in the record room. And we're talking, and the records lady, one of the ladies, talking to us and telling us about different things. And then she says, you remind me of Dr. Mondragon, Dr. Mondragon. She had been there the first time I had been there, because we'd have to go down and review our charts and sign our charts on a regular basis. It was amazing, but just some great people that I got to work with over the years. And then our last duty station was in Augusta, Georgia, at Eisenhower Army Medical Center, where I was, again, chief of Department of Medicine. So worked with great people, helped train some amazing residents and medical students, PA students. Just some great experiences. And while I was at Eisenhower Army Medical Center, I deployed for the last time to Iraq for another year, 2010 to 2011.
How did all of the deployments and, I guess, your 26 years in the military in general, but especially your deployments, how did all of that affect you in your life, in your family?
It gives you a much greater appreciation. Well, a few ways. Certainly a much greater appreciation for your family and your time with your family. I lost over 3.5 years, 37 months out of the life of my family. And you don't get that time back.
No,
you don't get that back. So all major, these major events that go on in your life, seeing things with your children happening, there are no do-overs with that. That's time lost. So you get a better appreciation for that. You also get a better appreciation for the freedoms, the opportunities we have in this nation. When you go to some of those countries, you realize, you see what poverty can be like. You see how certain citizens are treated. You see women who are treated like cattle in some cases, like property, that the lack of rights. You see these people who want to be able to vote, that it's not just a rigged election, but they actually have a say in their country's democratic process. The appreciation. And one of the things that was so poignant too, Michael, was the fact that these, so many people, every place I've been, whether that's on a mission trip to Guatemala, whether that's in Iraq, whether that was in Bahrain and other places that I've been, there, how many people would come and say, my dream is to go to the U.S. and become a U.S. citizen. I heard that over and over and over again. And when I would get back home, I would feel like kissing the ground, because I realized, by virtue of being born American, the privileges, the opportunities that I have are so different than so many people around the world. So it gave me appreciation for that. But being deployed, you get to see Army medicine practiced in the field, because Army medicine is world-class medicine. But you get to see it in the field practice again in a world-class way. It's really mind-boggling. Some of the things that we do in a field setting, in a combat zone, and taking care of soldiers, taking care of other service members, the things that we do, literally, world-class. Not just back in brick and mortar facilities, but there in the field. Unbelievable. And again, working with some great colleagues, amazing staff that I had there at the 21st Cache and other places that I've worked. So that appreciation and that idea that you're working for a cause so much greater than yourself, that brotherhood that you have. And when you've deployed with people and you've been in a combat zone with people, let me tell you, you build some strong bonds.
And it's all about really putting into practice what most of us really can only think about as theory, because unless we've been subjected to it and need medical help or have been involved in the situations like you, it's not the same. We're not connected to it. And it's so important, it seems to me, to help people understand that connection and the values that you're exactly what you're talking about.
Yes. Yes. Now you were asking about the impact on my family. Well, think about that. My first time in Deploy, my wife has three young children. Adam was six, Chris was four, Angeli was two, and she's expecting our fourth. We're deploying to this war zone that's very uncertain, knowing he's got Scud missiles, he's got chemical weapon arsenal, that he's used this, and you're going into this very uncertain war zone, not knowing when you're coming back home, or even if you're coming back home, all of this uncertainty. The night they announced that, okay, the war had started, that officially had kicked off there, that hostilities had started, it was announced on TV. And the kids were at a swimming lesson at the pool, I believe. And somebody came running through, some young soldier or something. The war has started. The war has started. And the children all started bawling. And so Sherry's trying to gather them up. And she's thinking, what are you doing? You know, trying to gather up the kids and get them home. But she didn't allow them to listen to any reports, do anything. Thankfully, we didn't have a TV at that time by choice. We didn't have a TV for many years, but she didn't allow them to listen to any reports because she didn't want them to hear these things.
Right.
But you can think about the uncertainty. You think about missing the events. You think about a spouse having to manage everything at home, taking care of the family, taking care of all the other things there that are involved in managing a household. That's what's left with that spouse, and then them carrying on without you. So adjusting without you. And then as those children are of different ages, again, all of that, your spouse taking care of that, and your family adjusting without you. Now, what people don't realize, they see these idyllic reunions. Oh, it's great. Look at, they're coming home and they're hugging and kissing and crying. And look at how wonderful that is. Well, yes, it is wonderful. It's magnificent. You can't believe the elation and the relief, and there's a short little honeymoon phase, if you will. But then the real work begins, reintegrating into your family, finding that new normal. How do I fit back into this? They've been without me for several months or even up to a year. My kids have changed. I've changed. Sherry's changed. Our family has changed. So how now do we find that new normal? And I think that's what a lot of people don't understand, that there is that work that needs to be done. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done after it. Service members return home from a deployment, that it's not easy, and it takes its toll. And I don't think that people realize the sacrifice when the service member has been gone for months and months at a time, years at a time, the sacrifice of that service member, the sacrifice of their family. With every promotion, every award that I received, I used to tell people, my wife and my kids deserve this a lot more than I do.
And another thing that comes to mind in thinking about this back in the time of Desert Storm and so on, and maybe up into Iraqi Freedom, I would think actually, is how were you able to communicate with home?
Oh,
with your family.
In Desert Storm, it was primarily snail mail.
Mm-hmm.
We did have the occasional call that we can make. Now, as the theater matured and they moved us out of living in tents, we got to move into hardened structure. And there I could make a regular phone call. When we got to OIF, there I could send email. And that became, so snail mail and email were the primary ways that we connected. The last time I was in Iraq, 2010 and 2011, again, it was email, but I could also, I had a card that I could charge minutes to that I can make through an international calling system that I could also place telephone calls. But the primary way became, again, snail mail and email to communicate with my family.
Today, is there additional kinds of ways of communicating, like with Zoom or Skype? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Now you're right. They can do face-to-face, Zoom, FaceTime. They have their cell phones, so if they're not restricted from using their cell phones, they can even get the international plan and call. We weren't able to do those kind of things.
Yeah.
There. Now, we did have one thing when I was in Haiti where it could go into a room and you could do via satellite. It was on a monitor that I could speak to, and they were in this special room there that it was big monitor, but it was a very limited time. And when that time ended, boom, the screen would just freeze. And the first time it ended like that, the kids actually started crying because I'm in mid-sentence saying something and I freeze on the screen and the kids didn't understand what was going on.
Yeah.
And it was so abrupt that Sherry told me later, the kids started crying when that happened.
Because they didn't know. They didn't know whether suddenly a bomb dropped or what.
Right. It was shocking to them.
Well, all of this obviously takes a toll on anyone who's subjected to it or who gets to do it. And I guess the other side of it is it's an honorable and a wonderful thing to be able to go off and serve people and help make the world a better place. But it eventually led to a depression for you, right?
Yes. I ended up with major depression, and it culminated on April 17, 2014, where I was curled up in a fetal position under the desk in my office. There, laying on that musty carpet, I had gone to work as I normally did. I get to my office that day early, as was my custom. Nobody else on the whole floor. I locked my office, turned on the lights, step inside, and everything just came crashing down on me. I was beat up, beaten down, and broken. She's behind me, locked the door, turned off the lights, closed the blinds, and I crawled under that desk. And for 4 hours, I'm asking myself, Skip, what are you doing? Skip, why are you here? What happened? You're a tough guy. You're a colonel. You've been in combat zones for over 18 months. You're a national wrestling champion. You're a tough guy. What happened? And very slowly, looking at that and scenes and memories colliding, looking at things, traumas, and difficulties, and I began to put the pieces together. And finally began to understand the symptoms I was having the past 9 months. Insomnia, impaired cognition, progressive blue moon, these negative thoughts that just pound at me day and night. You're a fake. You don't deserve to be a colonel. You let your family down. You let the army down. Who's going to want to hire you? Loss of confidence, indecision, loss of passion in things that I normally love. No interest in rest, joy. I had no joy in my life. It's like walking through life in black and white. My body, old injuries, overuse injuries, the osteoarthritis, my body just ached. Make it even worse. My libido, my sex drive was in the toilet. No, you talk about kicking a guy when he's down. And I finally was able to put those pieces together after 4 hours. And I was finally able to understand. I said, Skip, you're depressed. Go get help. And I crawled out from under that desk with a flicker of hope. And later that afternoon, I was seeing a clinical psychologist to confirm the diagnosis of major depression.
How come it took so long for you to get to that point, do you think?
It was my tough guy mentality. This idea that you just keep pushing through. That tough guy identity is like a double-edged sword. That tough guys just keep pushing through. It was a lot of things. Colonel, combat vet, physician, wrestler. So I took on this tough guy persona. And we even have a term for it in wrestling. We call it gutting it out. No matter how hard your lungs, how much your lungs burn, how much your muscles ache, no matter how hard this is, you're just going to keep pushing and pushing. So that was my modus operandi. That's how I operated in my life. You just keep pushing hard and pushing through these difficulties. But with it, I couldn't see, step back far enough to see what was going on. I knew it felt horrible. I couldn't sleep. I felt badly. I didn't want to be around people. I was withdrawn. But I couldn't step back even as a physician and put these together to say, oh, I'm depressed. It was just, keep pushing. And the harder I pushed, the worse I got. So it was that blindness from that tough guy identity that there, and probably some denial going on perhaps. But even as I look back retrospectively, that tough guy mentality just didn't help me, allow me to see that until it got so crucial where I was just totally depleted and ended up under that desk.
So how would you define being a tough guy today as opposed to what you thought back then?
Yes. Well, there are two sides to a tough guy, Michael. I see a tough guy, certainly one aspect of the tough guy, as that provider, protector, that decisive individual, that decisive man that can do things that need to be done now and can make those tough decisions no matter what. That's one aspect of it. So, yeah. But that other aspect that balances is, so we think of that one tough guy, you might say that's your, in part, your rugged individualistic guy that you see, that macho tough guy that the screen portrays, at least aspects of that. But then you see this other aspect of that tough guy. This is the individual that can be in touch with his emotions, can understand and able to dig there into that and say, oh, I'm feeling sad. You know what? What you just said really hurt me. I'm disappointed with that. Able to shed tears openly, able to show that tenderness, that love very openly, but to balance it between the two sides appropriately. That's what I see as a true tough guy. It's not just the one or the other. It's that blend of both that we need in our lives to make us a tough guy. And if you have only one or the other, you're not a tough guy. If you only have the tenderness and the warmth and the gentleness and the ability to share your emotions, well, guess what? You're not going to be a tough guy. You're going to run over. People can take advantage of you. They're not going to be much of a protector for those you need to protect. But if you only have that other side of you, you know, you're very limited. You know, and you're not going to be able to function in the full array of what we're meant to function in as men.
Or women.
Or women. Absolutely. It's not just restricted to one sex. Absolutely. You're right, Michael.
So you wrote a book, Wrestling Depression is Not for Tough Guys, right?
Not for wimps. Yes,
not
sir.
Not for wimps. I'm sorry. Wrestling Depression is for tough guys. Wrestling Depression is Not for Wimps. Tell us about that and how it affected you and your family writing that.
Well, that book, the genesis of that book came about, I was about 6 weeks into my recovery, but still struggling. And throughout the time that I was sinking down deeper and deeper into the depression and the first several weeks of my recovery, my prayers had been, Lord, please deliver me from this darkness. About 6 weeks into my recovery, my youngest brother, Chris, calls me. He had been at a Bible study with Franklin Graham, son of Billy Graham, And Franklin talked about the suffering of Christ. And the gist of it was, if Christ suffered so brutally upon that cross, why, as Western Christians, do we think we should be immune from suffering? And over the next 2 days, the verse that kept coming to my mind was from Philippians 2:13, where Paul writes, "Oh, that I might know him and the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings." I knew that verse. I knew it well. I'd prayed that verse hundreds of times in my walk with Christ. But in the midst of my suffering, I wanted deliverance. But over 2 days, my prayer shifted from, "Lord, please, please deliver me," to, "Lord, what would you have me learn? And how might I use it to serve others?" And at that point, I knew I was going to have to share my story. I didn't know how or when, but I knew I must share my story. So I began to note what lessons I had learned and what lessons I was learning with the intent of sharing those. First time I got to do that was at a officer professional development day there at the hospital at Eisenhower Medical Center. Our session in the morning, our session in the afternoon, and the hospital auditorium. And that became the genesis for my book. I won a writing contest in 2015, the year after we retired from the Army. And with that came a contract to have my book published. And then it was the process of going through the whole process of writing the book, editing the book, selecting the book cover, all the things that go with the book. But the writing that book was life transforming. It was transformational to me. And so I learned so many things about myself writing this book.
Did you have fun writing it?
I had fun at times. Other times it was a grind and almost chickened out at the point where we had everything finished. It was ready to go to the publishers, and I was on the cliff, so to speak. The book midwife, as we called her, the lady I was working with, Carrie Jareed, lovely, lovely lady with the company there, Capucia Publishing, it's now called, it used to be Transformational Books. I called her and I said, "Carrie, I don't know. I think I need to scrap this whole book. I think I need to start over. I can write a much better book." And she goes, "No, Skip. This book is ready. We need to get it birthed. We need to send it to the publisher." And I'm thinking, "Oh, no, no, no. I need to rewrite this whole thing. I can do a much better job at this after working." You know, we've been working on this thing for 2.5 years, getting this thing ready. And I'm praying about it. I'm talking about it. And then later I call her back in a day and a half and say, "Oh, okay, Sherry talked me off the cliff. And we're going to send this book forward." But with that, learn things about yourself going through that. Access some memories that I hadn't thought about, and some things, some traumas that occurred that affected me in profound ways that I didn't realize how much of an impact that had on my life and for how long that had an impact on my life. Case in point. I lost the state wrestling championship as a senior in high school by 2 seconds of writing time, meaning my opponent, Matt Martinez from Greeley West High School, knew Matt there. He beat me by controlling me when he was on the top position for 2 seconds. He had 2 seconds more of writing time controlling me on that mat. That I escaped from him 3 seconds earlier, he wouldn't have had any writing time. And we would have gone into overtime. And I believe I would have beat Matt in overtime because nobody could match my conditioning. But it didn't get to there. So I relived that match thousands, probably tens of thousands of times. But what it did is it really devastated my confidence. And that carried on into my first couple years of college, my college wrestling, just a lot of things about me. And what I didn't realize, it took 3.5 years, no, actually five years. I was 73 It was 78, the spring of 78, when I was finally healing from that and regaining my mojo. And I didn't realize that until I was writing this book, that profound impact that loss had and the ripples, the effects that went on for those successive years there, the profundity of that. And there were other things that I came to light. So there'd be times I'd be laughing. There'd be times I'd be crying. There'd be times I'd be like, whoa, wow. So it was an amazing experience.
So what are some tips that you would give to anyone dealing with depression today?
Tips. Thank you for asking that, Michael. First and foremost, men or anybody, if you're struggling, don't struggle one more day in silence. Please, please, please go get help. Two, remember, you're never, never, never alone. Three, keep your head up. In wrestling, we talk about this. Keep your head up. Instill this in our young wrestlers. Why? Because if they're on their feet and they drop their head, they get taken down to the mat. If they're down on the mat and the opponent's on top of them and drop their head, they can be turned over and pinned. But that's also figurative and emotional. Keep your head up. Keep your head up. And I needed people speaking into my life, like my wife, my family, my friends, my therapist, others speaking into my life and saying, Skip, keep your head up. Psalm 3:3 says, the Lord is our glory and the lifter of our heads. So I tell people, you're never, ever, ever alone. Third or fourth, I would say, attend to the basics. Sleep, healthy nutrition, and some regular activity. Those basics are the basics for good reason. And I call them the big three. And probably the most important of all of those, if you're having dysregulation of your sleep, is get your sleep back under control. And the last And then the last few that I would say is make sure you've got a battle buddy. Make sure you have somebody that you can turn to, somebody that you can confide in, somebody that you know will just listen and walk this journey with you. And a prescription. There's many other things that I talk about in my book, but a prescription that I have left with thousands and thousands of patients. I've written this on prescription pads, and I've shared this with patients. And I say, this medication has no bad side effects. This medication has no drug-to-drug interactions, and you cannot overdose on this medication. So I want you to take this medication liberally each and every day. Proverbs 17:22 says, a merry heart doeth good like a medicine, but a broken spirit drieth up the bones. And when I was depressed, I had a broken spirit. So laughter is good medicine. So I say each and every day, laugh and laugh heartily. Find something that you can laugh about. It's good medicine.
Whenever I want to laugh, all I have to say is I wanted to be a doctor, but I didn't have any patients. See?
Oh, that's great.
There you go.
Well, I tell people in retrospect, I say, gee, if I had only been my own doctor, I would have diagnosed myself sooner.
See?
Well, wait, I am a doctor.
Or, you know what the doctor said as he sewed himself up, suit yourself. yeah. I got that from an old Inner Sanctum radio show. But anyway, last thing, because we've been going a while, and just to at least mention it, you have been a TEDx speaker.
Yes, sir. I was a TEDx speaker, indeed.
And I gather that went well.
Oh, it was amazing. I was a TEDx speaker in Vancouver in December of 2021. My talk is entitled "Tough Guys Are an Endangered Species." And standing up there on the TEDx stage was a culmination of almost 9 months of preparation. Our mentor, Roger Killen, tremendous in helping prepare myself and some colleagues for this, with the help of his sidekick, Dorothea Hendrick. Just lovely, lovely people. But to stand on that stage and deliver my talk, which is about 12 and a half minutes, started off at about 16 and a half, 17 minutes, kept cutting it down. But to stand there and deliver this message directed to tough guys, talking about emotions and the inability that men often have in accessing our emotions because of the way we've been conditioned, the way we've been raised, the expectations placed on us. In fact, there's a medical term that was coined that's masculine alexithymia, which means feelings without words, and how that then sets men up that I'm okay. I don't need help. I don't need to share my feelings. And we lose contact with our feelings. Men don't seek medical care as often as women in general, much less when they're struggling with mental health issues, that denial, that tough guy. And now they seek it in maladaptive behaviors. I talk about that. But the ultimate behavior becoming suicide.
Which is why you have given us a new and much better definition of tough guy.
Yes, sir. Indeed.
And it is very clear that wrestling depression is not for wimps. See, I get it right that time.
There you go.
Well, I want to thank you for being here with us on Unstoppable Mindset. Clearly, you have an unstoppable mindset. And I hope people get inspired by it and inspired by all the things you've had to say. If they'd like to reach out to you, how might they do that?
The easiest way for them to reach out, Michael, is go to my website, www.transformtoughguys.com. www.transformtoughguys.com. And there you could send me a message.
Send you a message, look at your book. Are you looking at writing any more books?
Yes, sir. I am looking to write another book, and still in the making, but I think the next book may be Wrestling Bullies is Not for Wimps.
There you go. Well, we want to hear about that when it comes out. So you have to come back and we can talk more about it.
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you again, Skip, for being with us on Unstoppable Mindset. I appreciate it. I appreciate you. And it's just easy to say you inspire me and all that, but I seriously mean it. I think you've offered a lot of good knowledge and good sound advice that people should listen to. And I hope that all of you out there appreciate this as well. And that you will reach out to www.transformtoughguys.com and reach out to Skip. Also, of course, we'd love to hear from you. Feel free to email me at michaelhi@accessibe.com or go to www.michaelhinkson.com/podcast or wherever you're listening to us. Please give us a 5-star rating. We appreciate it. We want to hear what you think about the podcast. If you've got suggestions of people who should be on, and Skip, same to you. If you know of anyone else that we ought to have on the podcast, would appreciate your help in finding more people and more insights that we all can appreciate. So again, thank you for being on the podcast with us.
It's been my pleasure, Michael. Thank you, sir.
Pleasure is mine.
You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MichaelHingson. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.